Good evening and welcome behind the news for January 8, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking to do most weeks at this time at the world of economics and politics. And we've got three interviews up for tonight. First, we'll talk with Anthony DaCosta about the Indian economy and specifically the software outsourcing boom there and what that has to do with the lives, economic lives of actual Indians. Then we'll talk with Anatole Levin of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace about the new Afghan constitution, whether that has anything to do with the lives of actual Afghans. And then we'll be speaking also with Joan Roloffs, who is a professor of political science at Keene State College in New Hampshire and author of a relatively new book called Foundations and Public Policy, The Mask of Pluralism, about the social and political roles of foundations, mostly big elite ones like Ford and Rockefeller. And we'll get to Anthony DaCosta in just a couple of minutes, but just a few words about the economic news. First of all, the weekly look at consumer attitudes in the United States, the ABC Money Magazine Consumer Comfort Index rose again last week because households are reporting an improved assessment of the national economy. And, a little deterioration. Oh, no, an improvement in the state of their personal finances as well. So this uptrend in consumer attitudes has been underway since late September, early October, and really does seem to be reflecting both improved optimism about the general national economy, but also about how people perceive the state of the job market. And that job market, again, looking a little better. Last week's tally of initial claims for unemployment insurance, that is the number of people who have just lost their jobs and head over to the unemployment insurance office to sign up for benefits, that rose a bit last week, 14,000, but the four-week moving average, which is what people look at mostly because the week-to-week numbers can be volatile and bounce all over the place, that fell by 6,000, and the number of people continuing to draw unemployment claims, the so-called continuing claims series, that fell by 12,000 and is at its lowest level in a couple of years. So it does look like the job market is improving rather slowly, but somewhat surely. Tomorrow morning at 8:30, we'll get the release of the job report for December. Very timely and important economic indicator because it measures both economic activity, but the impact of economic activity on actual human beings. And we're expecting, or I'm expecting, a smallish positive number, maybe 100,000 new jobs, 120,000 new jobs. No change in the unemployment rate. And certainly, while that's better than what we've been seeing, we saw for most of 2003, it's still not the kind of vigorous growth you usually see in an economic recovery when you'd see 200,000, 300,000, 400,000 jobs added a month. And still well below the long-term average, which is about 200 or 220,000 new jobs a month. So things do seem to be improving, but they still have a long way to go in the job market. It was also reported today that the Christmas season was saved from disaster by a bunch of last-minute shoppers. We had the best Christmas season in several years. It's, of course, as Russell Baker said a couple of years ago, the Christmas season is really a festival of consumption, and this is a very important measure of how the consumer side of the U.S. economy is doing. But interesting distribution. The discount chains were suffering even more pricing pressure. That is, even the mighty Walmart was forced to discount below its already low prices to get to move goods off the shelves. And some of the weaker discounters, like Kohl's, have had quite a bad season. But the ones who really were thriving were Tiffany and Neiman Marcus. Does seem to be characterizing the general U.S. retail scene these days. That is, the discounters who cater to middle and lower income shoppers getting a lot of sales, but they have to cut prices very deeply in order to gain those sales. The elite retailers, the Tiffany's and Neiman Marcus's of the world, doing very, very well, and they don't have to do much discounting because their customers have pretty fat wallets these days because of tax cuts from George Bush and because the stock market did rather well last year. So richer shoppers are richer than they were a couple of years ago, and they're showing it by spending it. And then in news from abroad, the Brazilian economy is looking like it's turning around. A very interesting story there. The government of Lula, which came into office on expectations that they were going to do some radical restructuring of one of the most unequal economies in the world, instead last year were quite orthodox, adopting anti-inflation policies and trying to please the financial markets and the IMF. Lula has claimed that this was just a part of a two-stage process to stabilize the economy and then get to work on growth and social justice issues. We shall see, but the stabilization kinds of measures don't necessarily comport very well with social justice measures either. So it does seem that the Brazilian economy is accelerating. We'll see if that's sustained, and we'll also see if that has much to do with the welfare of real Brazilians. We'll be looking at that later this year. And also, now let's turn to the matter of the Indian economy. India, according to the big numbers like GDP statistics, has been doing quite well, booming in recent years, clocking 6-8% growth rates, which are not quite Chinese levels, but are quite impressive nonetheless. And, of course, India is much in the news in the United States these days because of the relocation of a lot of call center jobs and software jobs, information technology kinds of jobs, to Bangalore and Indian cities like that, causing a lot of distress among Americans. But possibly some good news for Indians. So we'll talk about that, these issues, with Anthony DaCosta, who teaches economics at the University of Washington's Tacoma campus. Welcome to WBI, Anthony.
Hi, thanks.
Thanks for joining us. Let's just... The Indian economy is reporting quite strong growth rates, 8%, I think, in the most recent GDP quarter. Where is this growth coming from, and how meaningful is it to actual Indians?
Let's see. We can actually break down this growth rate into a number of, let's say, sectors. One, of course, would be the so-called manufacturing sector. Indian manufacturing is not at all known in the world, generally speaking. But I think in the last 15 years or so, there has been some kind of, you might say, a quiet revolution, very sort of underappreciated or undernoticed. Changes in manufacturing capability. And a lot of this possibility is precisely because of new kinds of technology transfers that have taken place with sort of liberalizing the technology policy. In other words, previously the government was very, very concerned with technology imports simply because of the scarcity of foreign exchange. And I think the government realized that by barring Indians from access to technology, it wasn't doing the economy very well in terms of, you know, its competitiveness. And so I think it gradually opened up the technology sector, becoming a little more liberal. It's not completely opened up, but it's certainly more liberal now than it was before. And so Indian firms are able to access fairly, I would say, state-of-the-art technologies, and if they can afford to, that is. And so they have been doing that. And at least in some of the very identifiable sectors, like, let's say, the automobile industry, which I've been studying for a number of years now, there I think we do find considerable improvements in their technological competence, in their manufacturing capability. And so the parts and components industry, which then go on to support the Indian automobile industry, I think it's doing quite well. And so it is very possible that in the future, in the very near future, I think we can see exports of components from India. So that's one sector I think I would say that is doing quite well. The other, of course, is well-known, the IT sector. That's really become a very, very big growth industry in India. It's basically clocking on the average, I would say, about, you know, anything between 40 to 50% growth rate on an annual basis in terms of revenues, that is. And so that obviously has a huge impact. It is already considered to be about, I think, maybe about 2.5% of the GDP in terms of revenue, sales. And in terms of export, I think it's a share of roughly about 20% of India's total exports. So that's a really big sector in terms of revenues and export competitiveness. If you look at the agricultural sector, although the productivity is pretty low by international standards, but in terms of output of grain, India basically shows a consistent increase and I would say a fairly good increase in terms of growth rates. So that's one area which is also doing well. So obviously there is a segment in the rural population, the landowners, which are, of course, are doing quite well in India as well. Now, of course, I'm sure you will ask me questions about distribution, so we'll leave it at that.
Yeah, let's ask some of those distribution questions, because a very large portion, perhaps the overwhelming majority, Indian population is rural and rather poor.
Uh-huh.
Is any of this these headline kinds of growth numbers actually being felt in their lives?
Actually, yes. I would say yes. Obviously, not to the extent that we would think that these numbers might translate into, but there is, actually. Because one of the things, I think, the real pull factor being that there is an urban demand for basically, you know, educated young people, if you will. And farming, by and large, I mean, India is also one of those societies which is undergoing, you know, what we traditionally call a modernizing society. You know, it is sort of getting rid of many of the legacies in what we call traditions in general, in a variety of ways, not completely, but certainly in a variety of ways. The younger generation is letting those things go, and they are moving into the cities, and education, modern education, that is valued in India by basically most classes across the spectrum. So what that means is that if there is economic development in the rural areas, and even assuming that it is largely the large landowners which are essentially benefiting, although it's not just large, I think there's also a middle category, which are also known as bullock capitalists. I might come back to that a little later. But basically, there is a segment of the rural population which is benefiting from this economic growth and from the industrial growth, partly because they are experiencing their own agricultural output increases, productivity increases, earned incomes, and then which is then funneled into a lot of diversified rural business. So a typical landowner, aside from owning, you know, relatively large chunk of land and basically farming commercially, this landlord is likely to reinvest some of his profits, let's say, in a trucking business, or have a bus company in the rural areas, and so on and so forth, or open up a grocery store selling a variety of rural as well as urban manufactured goods. Which means that there is fairly successful accumulation going on in the rural areas. This in itself acts as a source of demand for the urban economy on the one hand. And the interesting thing, if you take a sociological approach to this, you find that the children of this particular landlord, land-owning family, they're likely to be educated in the urban areas. They're likely to pursue professional degrees like medicine or engineering and so on, although these days I think the business opportunities are increasing, so that's likely to be a shift as well. And so what we find then that this growth, although on the surface it might not translate into a widely distributed sort of experience, but we do find that this is actually going into the hinterland as well.
Well, if you listen to people like Vandana Shiva, there's, you know, nothing but tales of
right.
ruination among India's peasants.
Mm-hmm.
Is that not a fair picture?
It's a fair picture only to the extent that once you have identified those very, very vulnerable groups, and I think that's certainly the case. I mean, obviously, in India, within the rural population, you have a large class of what we call in India landless workers, which presumes, of course, that previously they must have had some land, but now they have been dispossessed for a variety of commercial reasons, indebtedness, and so on. So those are the most sort of vulnerable groups. And what we find, of course, is that for them, any change, any slight change in the prices of commodities, food grains especially, or changes in some prices of some kind of public service means that they are going to be really in the doldrums. So I think that group is really vulnerable. And to some extent, yes, I think there is a certain encroachment in terms of, let's say, the big business in terms of introducing, you know, the hybrid seeds and so on, which creates a certain kind of dependency, I think. So there might be then those kinds of vulnerabilities associated with these groups of people. So Vandana Shiva is absolutely not right in the sense that there are obviously pockets of rural areas which are actually doing quite well, and small towns as well, but then there are also these vulnerable groups. So the picture is fairly mixed, but what she does, of course, I think she plays up the somber stories more so than the other ones.
I'm speaking with Anthony DaCosta, who is an economist teaching at University of Washington's Tacoma campus. You quote, you have a recent paper on the role of the software industry in the Indian economy, and you quote a CEO saying, you have fiber optic lines running parallel with bullock carts. The U.S. does not understand it. Could you talk about that, these contradictions of Indian life right now?
Yeah, I think, India is a classic sort of late industrializer, which Alice Amundsen, in her work on Korea, sort of fostered that idea that, late industrialization is a slightly different kind of experience. For India, it is much more so simply because of the hugeness of the country, the sociological complexity of the country. So what that means is that, there is always going to be some sectors in India which are going to be lagging, and there will be some sectors which will be really rapidly changing. And I think this one really captures it very well because in India, these days, no matter, which city you are in or even small towns, and even in some villages, we are witnessing the establishment of internet sites or internet kiosks, which is a very interesting development because these communities, in fact, even myself, 20 years ago, where I grew up, basically I lived in a fairly telephone-less, TV-less world. And today, of course, India is very, very different in the sense that these advanced sort of industries, if you look at the industrial sort of ladder, these advanced industries are certainly making their presence felt in India, which older industries actually did not make themselves felt in India in the same way. So what we have then is that there are those laggards, and then there are those advancing sectors. So the bullock carts, of course, for a variety of other non-economic reasons, I mean, they are still going to be viable in the sense that a farmer still sort of uses bullock carts to transport his output or carrying, carrying luggage or whatever it is. So that mode of transportation will continue. But at the same time, I think, if you go into the same rural areas, you'll find that the farmer will also probably have a couple of cars, and some of them are actually quite modern Japanese sort of technology sort of type of cars. His sons will probably be riding on motorcycles and so on. So even within a single household, you will find a variety of different kinds of assets. And a bullock cart should be seen in those terms. But what it does, of course, is that our understanding of modernizing society must be seen in a different light, in the sense that it's really not a sort of a reproduction of the American or the Western sort of modern society where the old basically vanishes and basically it's always everything is new. I think in India is basically you have the coexistence of the old and the new, and I don't think there are any immediate signs that the old is going to go away very quickly.
I've got the outsourcing of information technology jobs and call centers and things like that from the U.S. Is attracting a lot of attention over the last year or so.
Right.
Could you talk about what kind of impact this is having on Indian incomes, Indian lives? How many people work in these industries? Are the jobs good from an Indian's point of view? And how should we really think about this this whole issue? It's very complicated politically.
Yeah, definitely. I think from the Indian side of things, I think this is a very good development. For a good development in the sense that finally, I think India has found a niche, if you will, in which its engineers can basically, do good creative work.
And India has lots of quite skilled engineers, right?
Right, exactly. In fact, in the IT industry, I think roughly there would be about now 500,000 people employed. Now, I can't sort of be sure exactly if all of them are with a bachelor's of engineering degrees and some, and what proportion that is. But basically, about 500,000 people are employed in the IT industry alone today, and that those numbers are actually increasing quite rapidly. India has always had a very, very good, small, percentage-wise, and elite sort of engineering sort of talent. But the thing is that during the, they were set up with a very good intent in the sense that this is how you sort of have an independent, autonomous economy, less reliant on the world economy. And so the entire import substitution industrialization was reliant on the domestic availability of engineers. And it served the Indian economy very well in the 1950s when a lot of new industries were being set up. And I think India was one of those very few post-colonial societies that was rapidly able to industrialize very quickly. But the problem, of course, is that the entire ISI model had lots of structural weaknesses and deficiencies, which meant that the employment sector was not growing rapidly enough. And, of course, if you pursue industrialization early on, it basically means that you're going to be capital intensive, you're not going to employ as many people, and so on and so forth. So there was a sort of a missynchronization, if you will, of the talent that was being generated and the Indian economy's ability to absorb them. And so you had a lot of frustrated, I would say, engineering talent floating around, often taking up very mediocre types of jobs, some clerical jobs, and so on and so forth. And then some, those who were lucky, who had some money, who had the contact and the sort of, entrepreneurial sort of insights, if you will, they basically left. So a lot of them actually came to the U.S. in the 1960s, although doctors also came in the 1960s to the United States, partly because of the U.S. shortages, I think, during the Vietnam War, which sort of pulled in a lot of people. But essentially what you had is a large number of engineers in absolute numbers, you had who basically were not finding the right sorts of employment. This is one sector, I think. What you find, of course, is that they're doing very, very well. They're very readily absorbed. And the sector is growing by leaps and bounds. And the interesting thing, although I think I've been a critic of this in some ways, in the sense that now basically we don't sort of emphasize, civil engineers or, chemical engineers and so on, although the need for those sorts of engineers are also very, very high in the Indian economy. So in some ways, it's a kind of an overcompensation of some sort, and you're essentially putting all your sort of engineers into this software IT basket, which I think is not the right way to go. But overall, I would say it's been very, very good for India in terms of employment creation. Now, with respect to certain types of IT jobs, which are, of course, clubbed under IT, but they are really not very technologically, sophisticated jobs, for example, the call center stuff. It's basically a very tedious, dead-end jobs. And obviously, the people who go into those jobs know that it is a fairly dead-end, and they'll basically try it out, for a couple of years. But what it has done, however, is that it has given or created new opportunities from the lower middle-class groups, whose opportunities were very limited in the employment market. They don't have any inheritance to begin with. They don't have any land, any other kind of wealth. Their parents may be in some middle class, low income sort of group. So the only way they could get some job is through education. Well, that was not being provided, in the previous sort of model, if you will, the ISI model. What you find now, of course, is that these jobs actually become a kind of a stepping stone. Now, it would be interesting, and I know there are some researchers actually pursuing this. In fact, worldwide, they're very interested and curious as to what do these people do after they work in these call centers. But I think what it has done is that it has opened up some space for these young people who basically, get jobs right away. They create a certain financial independence and so on and so forth. So in that respect, I think it's a very, very good development. But as I said, from a larger policy perspective, I think the Indian government needs to rethink about the other sectors, and manufacturing being one of them. Of course, there is a link between the IT sector and its application to the traditional manufacturing industries. In fact, a lot of the traditional manufacturing industries have been, rejuvenated with these new technologies, and I think India needs to do that, which means then, as I said before, that some of the manufacturing industries are emerging, which means that the use of IT would be very, very important for them. And I think the government is recognizing it. The problem, of course, is that Indian businesses are sort of short on cash. They don't want to make these kinds of investments. And so it will take a while for them. But I think they've recognized that, they can become more efficient if they adopt some of these new technologies.
All right, we'll have to end it there. Thank you for joining us. We're out of time. Anthony DaCosta, who teaches economics at the University of Washington's Tacoma campus. And we'll be back. We'll have you back soon, I hope, to do more talking about the Indian economy. Very interesting stuff. And we'll be back with this show in just a moment after this little excerpt from Paul Oakenfold's Global Underground New York City mix. And that was a little excerpt from Paul Oakenfold's Global Underground New York City mix. Classic of the genre from 1998. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM on the radio dial and on the internet at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. And now we're joined by Anatole Levin, who is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a frequent guest here on this show. Welcome to WBAI, Anatole Levin.
Hi.
So there was a lot of cheerleading in the American press about the achievement of an Afghan constitution the other day. You had a skeptical piece in the Financial Times yesterday. Tell us why you're not joining the squad of pom-pom shaking cheerleaders.
Well, I'm clapping with one hand. I mean, what a lot of us were afraid of was that the entire constitutional convention would collapse in bitter ethnic and religious recriminations. Well, that didn't happen, and that, of course, is a good thing in itself, the fact that Afghan representatives can get together and at least pretend to agree on something. But firstly, this agreement was only produced by the most intense arm-twisting by Washington, by Europe, by the United Nations. It never, came to a public vote. For that matter, the final draft never came to a public discussion. It was all hammered out in private deals about which we know not very much. But the second point is that, of course, at present, but also in my view for a very long time to come, this constitution remains completely theoretical. It bears absolutely no resemblance to the real situation in Afghanistan, the real distribution of power. And what I'm afraid of is that all these cheerleaders will actually succeed in convincing the American public and possibly even themselves that this constitution is in some way reality, that it represents real and not just symbolic progress, and that therefore it has brought us somehow closer to the moment when we can safely pull out of Afghanistan, at least in part, and leave the Afghans to themselves. Now, this, in my view, will not be a safe thing to do for very many years to come.
You wrote in the FT yesterday that Western aid has gone mainly to fatten the capital city, which now risks becoming a bubble of artificial prosperity in a sea of heavily armed misery. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Well, yes. I mean, this, of course, is not exactly the fault of the West, because it's so difficult to distribute aid in the rest of the country. Firstly, because there are no government structures to do so, and secondly, of course, because of the security situation. A considerable number of aid workers have been killed. But the result is that, it does now look very like places like Dili, the capital of East Timor, or Phnom Penh in Cambodia, when the UN was heavily involved there, where you get one city where all the Western aid workers, officials, diplomats, and many of the soldiers are concentrated, and the money pours in there, creating a bubble of prosperity, but doesn't really affect the rest of the country at all. Now, the risk is, as we've seen in many African countries, that in the long run, the rest of the country doesn't tolerate that, and you get the formation of armed groups who are basically dedicated to seizing the capital and stealing its prosperity for themselves.
The joke is that Karzai is the mayor of Kabul, that there's really the government doesn't have much influence outside the capital city. Is that the case? And are the hinterlands really dominated now by warlords and traditional forms of authority?
Well, absolutely. But it's also true that Karzai is not even the capital, the mayor of Kabul. The defense ministry in Kabul is controlled by rivals, political rivals of his, from the Panjshiri Tajik clan. So he has no security forces of his own in Kabul, really. His security is provided partly by the U.S., which actually provides his personal bodyguard, and then the wider security of his government in Kabul is provided by NATO through the international peacekeeping force ISAF. So it's actually wrong to say even that he's the mayor of Kabul. I mean, he is a power, but he's above all a power because we, the West, the outside world, have made him a power. When it comes to actual power and authority in Afghanistan, it's very unclear just what he has, really.
When I interviewed Ivo Dalder from the Brookings Institution a couple of months ago in this program, he said that he thought that the Bush administration was contemplating an Afghan model for Iraq, that is to mostly pull out the armed forces and try to create some sort of Karzai-ish kind of government. Do you think that's what the administration is thinking of? And if so, is that an encouraging precedent?
I think they are thinking roughly along these lines. And no, I think it's an extremely discouraging precedent. Because in Afghanistan, you have maintained basic peace between the different groups, excluding the Taliban, by allowing them to run their own areas and by turning the government in Kabul into a kind of national negotiating committee. The U.S., having done that for 2 years, is now trying to build up the chairman of that committee, Karzai, as an effective president, but with very little to actually, you know, back the effort in this regard. Now, this has not perhaps made so much of a bad difference in Afghanistan, because Afghanistan always was a bitterly poor country with a minimal state in which most people, you know, were just used to surviving at a subsistence level. Iraq's very different. I mean, Iraq was a considerably, at least semi-modernized state. Iraqis expect the state to be able to do things for them in terms of providing services, security, energy, and so forth. The Afghan model applied to Iraq will not be able to do that, and I think it will lead to many Iraqis becoming radically infuriated with the situation.
What can be done in Afghanistan? Should just the foreign forces pull out and leave things to Afghans to figure out for themselves? Or is there some constructive thing that foreign interests can do there?
I don't think that we should pull out. Firstly, because, after all, Afghanistan was the place which incubated al-Qaeda and led to 9/11. Our own security interests demand that we stay there. Secondly, we have made a moral commitment, and it's not just a moral commitment as a result of, you know, what happened on 9/11, but I think we also need to recognize that U.S. policy in the 1980s of backing the Mujahideen, followed by the American abandonment of Afghanistan in the 1990s, was grossly immoral and contributed enormously to the collapse of that country and the rise of al-Qaeda. So we have a moral commitment to stay. But I think what we have to recognize is that to transform Afghanistan in a positive direction will be a matter not of years, but of decades. So on the one hand, we don't need to be in such a hurry, you know, to create an effective Afghan government. Because in any case, we're not going to be able to pull out for a generation to come without risking real disaster. So we can go more slowly, but at the same time, we have to commit ourselves really solidly to long-term goals and work steadily and consistently towards them. So I would say more haste, less speed.
And finally, I keep reading reports about U.S. attempts to bring moderate Taliban into the government. Is that as surreal as it sounds?
Well, no, not really, because a lot of the people who joined the Taliban were not the original Taliban, which was a very small group, but basically opportunists who, before joining the Taliban, had been, you know, part of half a dozen other groups. The fact is that these people do dominate a lot of society in Afghanistan, in the Pashtun areas. So in many ways, this is just, you know, political realism. But one does have to recognize that you cannot do this and at the same time engage in big talk about rapid, radical transformation of Afghan society and women's rights and so forth. I mean, transformation of this kind, as I've said, will take many, many years. And this attempt at reconciliation with parts of the former Taliban is just a really strong sign of that.
All right, well, thanks for joining us on Total Even.
Thank you.
Anatole Levin is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C., and we'll be back in just a moment after another word from Paul Oakenfold. Another bit from Paul Oakenfold's Global Underground New York mix double CD set from 1998. And now we're joined on the line by Joan Roloffs, who is the author of the book Foundations and Public Policy, The Mask of Pluralism, recently published by SUNY State University of New York Press. Welcome to WBAI, Joan.
Hello.
So, foundations, they're not often written about very critically. And most people think they're pretty good guys. They sponsor nice art stuff and community organizations and sort of blunt some of the roughness of American society. What's your beef against them?
Well, I think they do blunt the roughness. And I don't exactly have a beef against them, but I'm a political scientist. And I'd like to write about how power is exercised. It's really important to know how the system is sustained, if you want to change the system, or if you want to maintain it. And this is a subject that is pretty much ignored by political scientists as well as journalists.
Why do you think it's so ignored?
Well, a lot of people have benefit from the system, I'm afraid. Many academics are supported by foundations, many programs and universities are supported by foundations, and many publications are supported, and think tanks. And I'm not talking about the right-wing ones, because they're written about a lot. I'm talking about the center ones and the left-wing ones.
Let's get some idea of the size of this sector. The foundation sector is quite large in the United States. Just give us some sense of how large they are.
Well, the latest figure I have is that the assets are about $450 billion. And foundations give away about $30 billion a year.
So that's pretty big.
That's pretty big. And a lot of it is not for political or social activities. A lot of it is for maintaining rather traditional institutions, you know, cultural universities and all of that. But it's extremely influential, even the small amounts they give, to tiny organizations, helps to quell dissent. It pacifies.
Let's talk about that. Let's go back into, the 1960s, which was a time of great ferment, as everyone knows.
Yes.
And a lot of foundations were very active in working to harness that dissent. Ford, for example. Can you talk
yes.
a bit about what kinds of things they did to co-opt the revolutionary energies of the 1960s?
Well, for one thing, they worked together with many other foundations, creating things like the National Urban Coalition. They created coalitions of foundations and brought into the act corporate foundations, which had existed for a very different purpose previously. They had existed more for public relations and that sort of thing. And what the organizations did, under a lot of direction by Ford, was to fund the mainstream civil rights organizations and steer them while doing so.
Which organizations are you talking about, and in what directions did they steer them?
Well, the NAACP was heavily funded by the Ford Foundation, even at the time of Brown versus the Board of Education, in fact. And the steering was to steer them away from any idea that the system needed radical change or that the problems of minorities in the United States were in concert with the minorities throughout the world, with the liberation movements throughout the world, steering them away from concerns about changing the structure of society or changing the foreign policy of this country, directing them much more towards integration and to getting a piece of the action, which actually happened. And one thing that I do discuss in my book is the National Council of La Raza and how this converted a very radical organization in the southwest of Chicanos into groups that were interested in things like getting McDonald's franchises in poor neighborhoods.
I should say I'm speaking with Joan Rawls, who teaches at Keene State College in New Hampshire and is also the author of the book Foundations in Public Policy, The Mask of Pluralism, just published or recently published by SUNY Press. One of the things that Ford and other foundations are very heavily involved in are kinds of community organizing, community development organizations. Could you talk about those a bit?
Yes, those are massive organizations to help bring some social services, housing, and jobs into communities. And they are actually doing that, but at a tremendous cost. They don't return a profit that one would expect them to return. It's a huge investment of money, and they include money not only from foundations, but also from private corporations and from government, creating community development corporations. And they manage, in some ways, to co-opt the leadership of radical movements into very cushy positions in those community development corporations. They also give jobs to people who would be otherwise unemployable, and these are subsidized jobs, and they will always be subsidized jobs. And there's nothing wrong with that, except that it is done under the cover that somehow we have a free enterprise society and that this is a normal part of it. By the way, I have to correct you on one thing. I do not teach at Keene State College. I forgot to mention I retired this last year.
Ah, okay. I was just reading this off the book. I noticed one thing in the book where you say that, I think this is in the 60s, that the foundations were quite consciously targeting not the rebellious children of the middle and upper classes but really the ambitious and upwardly mobile younger members of the oppressed classes. Which reminds me, Marx, I think, said that the better a ruling class is able to incorporate the natural leaders of the oppressed population, the more solid and dangerous its rule. But could you talk about how they did that and the kinds of people that they groomed to become their loyal lieutenants?
Well, there were a very large number of leadership training grants given, and that still occurs, to find people who, had talent and to train them for some position or other, often as executives in non-governmental organizations.
NGOs, it's very fashionable these days, this ideology of civil society and the civic sector, the third sector. What's that all about, and how do the foundations fit into that?
Well, there's a lot of talk about civil society. They often don't mention all the aspects of it, because many of the organizations in civil society have very little to do with democracy. Many of them are actually quite exclusive and elitist and racist or even fascist in some ways. But the use of the term is considered a very good thing. And what has been created is an enormous sector, really. In terms of the economics of the sector, I think it's about one-tenth of the economy. But what is significant about it is that one of the things it does is that it absorbs the surplus labor, the surplus intellectual labor that might otherwise become unemployed and dangerous, because this is the really dangerous class in a society. Unemployed artists and intellectuals and social workers and people of that sort. So this sector absorbs people in thousands of tiny little projects. It keeps them busy, it keeps them employed, they're doing good work. I don't say they're doing bad things. But it also keeps them rather separate from everyone else who might have some problems with the system. People are encouraged to look at their own domain exclusively. And in fact, people I've spoken to report that there's a lot of competition between people who are running organizations for minority rights or benefits or whatever, that they are actually competing, those organizations are competing with each other. And they absorb a lot of resources, but they keep a lot of people employed. And the same thing is true of artists, too. A huge amount of art would hardly exist in our society if not for foundation funding. And includes not only classical music, but folk art and experimental art. Everything that isn't market-based, like pop music, would hardly be able to exist without being subsidized. But by being subsidized by foundations, the people who produce that kind of art are really beholden to the whole system, because the money comes from the capitalist system. The foundation money is invested in regular stocks and bonds. And if you are interested in getting anything for your organization, you don't criticize the system. It's so rare. There was one case in Keene that was amazing because it was so unusual, where a man who had an old family, manufacturing family in this area, had been a volunteer for the Red Cross for 50 years in Keene. And one day he parked his car in the driveway of the Red Cross when he was going there to volunteer, and it had in it anti-war signs that were prominently displayed. And he was asked by the director of the Red Cross to remove those signs. He refused and he resigned from the Red Cross. But that is so rare. Most people say, well, I'm doing some good, so I will let them determine what my views are that I'll express. That's more common.
Well, a lot of people might listen to this and say, well, you know, there may be some problems with these foundations, but they're a lot more humane than a world that would be dominated by Rupert Murdoch and the Heritage Foundation. You know, would just be on the mercies of commerce for culture, and the right wing would be even more powerful than it is now. And a lot of people on the right wing despise these foundations and think of them all as a nest of practically Bolsheviks.
So, that's right.
Well, what would you say to people who say, you know, that maybe they're not so bad?
Well, my primary purpose is not to pass moral judgments on foundations. My primary purpose as a political scientist is to show how power is exercised. And in my book, I talk of a lot of incidents of this, but there are thousands more that I personally can't document because it's such an enormous field. And I want to wake up the researchers to look at this to see how power is exercised. Now people might decide that it's a good thing. That's all right. I'm not trying to condemn foundations, really. I'm just trying to bring them into the light of day. And they don't want that light shined on them. And for that, I will condemn them. That the mainstream foundations do not want that much evidence of their activity to be public. But other than, but what they do, well, you know, people can have their own judgments on that.
Okay, well, one way people can have that judgment is by buying your book.
That would be fine.
I've been speaking with Joan Roloffs, who is the author of Foundations in Public Policy, The Mask of Pluralism, published fairly recently by the State University of New York Press, the SUNY Press, and available in better bookstores. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'm not sure exactly when I'm going to be back, because the fundraising will commence soon, but I will be back. And till then... so long. And let's go out with another bit from Paul Oakenfold's Global Underground New York City Mix from 1998. This is a song by Crystal.